Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When did you stop believing in monsters? It may have been decades since you begged your parents to check under the bed or worried about actually running into some terrifying mutant you saw in a movie. Stories about serial killers, terrorists, and deadly pandemics, on the other hand, still give many of us the creeps, even when we know the odds of meeting our end this way are incredibly slim. So what accounts for humankind's long fascination with monsters, and what do our visions of malevolent creatures reveal about the horrors of real life? Stephen T. Asma is professor of philosophy at Columbia College, Chicago. His book, now available in paperback, is called On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you give us a universal working definition of the concept of monster?
Not really. I wish I could have started the book with, you know, a clear definition, but it turns out to be a very multi-use term and concept, and we use it to apply to things that we would call sort of natural monsters, you know, your cryptozoology like Bigfoot and Loch Ness Monster, that sort of thing, but also we apply it to sort of immaterial, incorporeal spirits that can possess you. We also use it more recently as a kind of moral term. So when somebody is a bad person, but they're sort of off the chart bad, we refer to them as monsters, and this is sort of how the news refers to serial killers and that kind of thing. So it's a very multi-use concept, and I was trying to see, well, what are the aspects that are sort of continuous through these different historical epochs and also through these different domains. And so I came up with a short list of what I think are the crucial defining characteristics.
Mm-hmm. So can you give us some basic idea of what those characteristics are?
Yeah, one is I think you find that monsters are kind of unthinkable. Whether it's a beastie out there or some kind of moral serial killer, it's hard for us to process the monster. We understand rage and anger, but we don't understand that kind of rage and anger. So that's one sense that you find sort of universal. Also that they're unmanageable. You can't negotiate with monsters. You can't, you know, the classic horror film, the family man says to the monster, "Don't kill me, I have kids," or the scientist says, "You know, you're so wise, we want to study you," and then they get bludgeoned anyway. Mm-hmm. This seems to be a common theme also. In other aspects, too, we have a kind of repulsion-attraction psychology with monsters. We're frightened by them, but we also can't look away, and we're drawn to them. So these are just a few of the aspects that are universal.
You know, it's really fascinating to think about people hundreds or thousands of years ago when the unknowns in the world had not yet been tamed at all by science. So for, say, the ancient Greeks, it wasn't such a stretch to imagine there might really be harpies and sirens and land-going octopi out there. They just didn't know.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, we live in a smaller world, relatively speaking, because we feel like we've explored more of it. But the ancient Greeks would come across these, and the Romans, we come across these bones that we now think of as, oh, these are extinct dinosaurs, but they had no idea of what a dinosaur was or even an idea of extinction per se. So they assumed that these creatures were really still out there somewhere. They're just in some faraway land or they're living deep in the water. And even Caesar, Augustus, used to collect these bones, and he believed that these represented creatures that were still out there. A classic example is the griffin, which is supposed to be part eagle and part lion, and Adrian Mayer, who's an interesting archaeologist, has argued, I think, very persuasively that this is what you come up with when you find a lot of these particular kind of dinosaur bones that look partly like they have a beak-shaped, front face, and this body, and so they were doing the best they could. But even as recent as Thomas Jefferson, Jefferson thought that when he sent the expedition out west, he said, keep your eye out for some of these giant monsters because they could still be living out there in the forest. So it's just kind of an amusing change from where we're at these days.
Hmm. Also for the Greeks, there was this sense that monsters, they were sort of tied up with the idea of warning about impending threats.
Yeah, that's right. The original meaning of monster was that it was an omen, and it was very common for, I think they were thinking of monsters in two ways. One was the what we would call it now genetically disabled child is born, like or developmentally disabled, conjoined twins, mm-hmm. a baby's born without missing limbs or too many limbs, two heads, this kind of thing. And they interpreted these as signs from the fates. And there are many cases where military generals would abandon campaigns if a child like this was born in the village nearby or in the province, because the augurs would interpret it as a bad sign, you know, we shouldn't go forward. And so there was also a belief that there were monstrous races that lived in Africa and India, and that they were natural, and they were like other animals that you meet, but they were, you know, one was a great one, was the Blemmyi, and they had no head, but their face protruded from the middle of their chest. Hmm. And they were just different species that you just had to be wary of.
It's funny to think about people believing these things, in that clearly it's like those urban legends you hear when you're in third grade. You know, well, my cousin's best friend's sister saw this thing happen.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of embellishing that's going on. And also, you know, they're traveler's tales where people would come back from parts of Africa and India and tell these stories. I give this example that I sort of start the book with, this letter that Alexander writes back to Aristotle, who's his teacher, from his campaign in India. And this is probably an apocryphal letter. It's probably not really Alexander, but it appears in the ancient world, and the medievals believed it was Alexander writing back. But in it, he describes all these fantastical monsters that he's meeting. And so the Greeks are getting this information and saying, wow, that India is a crazy place. Look out. Hmm. And one way is it could just be pure fancy on the part of the writer. On the other hand, oftentimes what happens is that one culture meets some new species, like the rhinoceros, for example, and has never experienced it before. So they try to describe it, but they just sort of oversell it. And that happens a lot in monster stories. They're real creatures at the bottom, but sort of they've had these... you know, their teeth are bigger, their claws are sharper, they're more massive in the stories and legends.
Well, in some ways, it sort of reminds you of, you know, when people report crimes and it was just a few seconds of panicky experience and they try to identify a witness, and often they're so very wrong.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, there's lots of evidence that you often, when people are asked, you know, how big was, you find somebody invading your home, and then people are asked how big was the person, and the person's like 7-8 feet tall, because, you know, your fear mixes with your perception and alters that perception. And that's a very important part of the sort of monsterology story, which is human beings, you know, project a lot of their own fears and vulnerabilities out into the world, and then they sort of read that back like it's objective fact, when in truth it isn't. So we see this time and time and again, either with regard to animals, or you just meet people who are very different from you, and the stories you tell embellish them to such a degree that they end up seeming monstrous to you.
Of course, the really sad thing about, you know, human beings who were labeled monsters because of some sort of genetic problem, they were not only demonized, but often victimized based on something they had no control over whatsoever.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the West has a long history of this, and I try to sort of trace some of this in the book. You know, this is a common phenomenon. If you're going to go to war against people, for example, you frequently what happens is people demonize the enemy to such a degree that it justifies your aggression. In some cases, you know, they are bad people and they're aggressors, and so one has to deal with them. But there's a long history of people demonizing people who are different and just engaging in kind of xenophobic monstering of another. Classic examples, of course, in our own country, African-American slaves were demonized with lots of stories that made them out to be sort of subhuman. The Nazis did this to the Jews during the Holocaust. The Hutus did this to the Tutsis in Rwanda. And so that's the really sad story about projecting our fears out into the world as monsters. And that, I try to detail some of that in the book.
Is that the same explanation for the prevalence of demons and supernatural hazards in more ancient Judeo-Christian tradition?
Yeah, there's sort of two traditions that I was able to trace in the ancient Judeo-Christian tradition. One is rather hostile, like the one we're just talking about now. If you're going to go out into the wilderness and meet the pagans, you know, you'd better be ready to sort of either convert them with rhetoric or by force, mm-hmm. a la the Crusades and this kind of thing. But then there was another tradition sort of held by St. Augustine in the Christian church, which was much more sort of tolerant. And he argues, this is probably the 5th century, you know, after the time of Jesus, and he says, there are monsters out there in India and Africa and in other parts of the world, but the question is, can we save them? Can we baptize them? Are their souls, you know, do they have souls? That was the big question. And he argues, look, if we talk to them and they seem rational, then we have to include them within the range of beings that have a soul, and therefore they'll be at the resurrection with us, and we should embrace them. So there was a kind of tolerant monster view, you know, in the early church, but I don't think that was the dominant one, and I don't think it lasted very long.
So was Augustine using the word monster in a literal sense, or was he referring in a sort of common xenophobic way to people perhaps of other races?
No, he was actually referring to it in a literal sense. Hmm. What happened is that the ancients sort of cataloged all these monsters that had been building up for hundreds of years, and Pliny, the natural history writer, a Roman, sort of condensed all this into a natural history book, which the medievals all read. And so the early Christians believed that there really were these specific monsters living out there. One was the blemii, which I was describing earlier. Also, they believed that there was the kynocephali, which were monster. They were men in terms of their arms and legs and their torsos, but then they had dogs' heads where the human head was supposed to be, and they just barked like dogs instead of, you know, having speech. And there was a variety of other monsters like this that Augustine believed were literally out there somewhere. But as to whether they could be saved, that was something we still had to figure out, apparently.
And wasn't there a Christian saint that was thought to have been converted from this dog-faced state?
Yeah. Yeah, this is not well known because there's sort of two versions of this saint. Most people in the States know about the sort of Western church, the Roman church's view of St. Christopher.
He's the travel guy.
Right, he's the travel guy. So he you have him on the dashboard of your car or whatever, and he's supposed to help with traveling. And the legend is he carried Jesus across a river. But in the Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition, St. Christopher is thought to be originally from this species of the dog-headed men. And he basically gets the good news. The Holy Spirit comes to him, and he converts, and God gives him the power of human speech, and he basically goes around proselytizing and converting people to Christianity until eventually the Roman Church, according to the, you know, this tradition, has him beheaded. But that's a case where the monster shows that there's some potential for salvation, and so this was part of this more humanistic view of monsters.
And I guess there's also even a sort of a pre-Calvinistic comfort to be taken. If you don't look like a monster, maybe that means that you are favorable in the eyes of God.
Yeah, it's sad, but there is a simple correlation that's frequently made between being ugly and being morally, you know, corrupt or, you know, at least suspicious. And monsterology makes a, you know, sort of plays with this throughout history. It equates unattractive with the immoral or the evil. So that's a long story as well.
Stephen T. Asma is my guest. He's professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago and author of the book On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have phone lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Stephen T. Asma, who is professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago and author of the book On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. It is now available in paperback. If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Stephen, I want to talk about the evolutionary value of monsters. One thing monster stories allow us to do, even today, is to sort of rehearse our fight or flight strategy for when faced with a powerful enemy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We kind of trivialize monster stories as being, you know, sort of a kid thing and, you know, maybe a playful moment for us. But I argue that there is something bigger going on here, which, as you said, is a kind of rehearsal. Because part of the monster story is not just what's the monster doing, but how are the people responding? And I don't really expect to encounter zombies anytime soon or vampires, but I do think there are a lot of jeopardy out in the world, and so you see the sort of rising tide of zombie narratives, and I think they're connected to anxieties that we have, for example, about well, what would happen if the grid were to go down? And all of a sudden we're competing with our neighbors for limited resources. Are things going to get ugly? Is it going to be this post-apocalyptic sort of survivalist scenario that many people is playing on many people's minds? And so I think many of us do sort of use the monster story as a way to think about, well, what would happen if I had a home invasion or found myself in some terrible scenario? In that sense, I think they're helpful because they allow us to kind of think about what we might do and organize our emotions in a way that could meet these threats. So I think they may have evolved as a strategy for dealing with real predators out in the world.
Yeah, it does seem like zombie stories are particularly interesting in that the foundation of them is people that we thought we knew suddenly being very frightening and changed.
Exactly. And you see that in many of the great monster stories, including things like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, mm-hmm. where the monster can sort of be your neighbor at one moment, but then be transformed into something that you can't predict, that you can't work with, something that's hostile toward you. And this is a deep fear. It was played on heavily during the Cold War period because, you know, during the sort of Red Scare of that period, it was thought that, well, hey, the monster, the godless communist could look just like your neighbor. And so you've got to be ever vigilant. And I think we see a little bit of that in the current scenario, too, after 9/11. Mm-hmm. We're all very anxious about terrorism and suicide bombers and this kind of thing. And how do we identify, you know, the threat? It's not like it's a giant King Kong that's taking over the city or a Godzilla. It could be somebody who looks just like your neighbor. And so that plays on our tendencies towards paranoia.
And even more terrifying even than the idea that they've infiltrated your community or your neighborhood is the idea that that contagion could somehow infect us, that we could become one of them.
Yeah, I think that's really something we're very much concerned with in the last 10 years in particular. I think it's a great fear that many of us have that we could actually, our personality could be taken away in some form or another. I mean, some of this is just playful. What would happen if I had my neocortex removed? I'd be like a brainstem zombie just sort of wandering around. But, you know, less trivially, a lot of us have anxieties about real problems like Alzheimer's or like severe, amnesia, where, mm-hmm. where you can actually lose your personality. It's the same body, but you're gone somehow. And these are sort of vulnerabilities that many of us share, and you see it played out in the monster stories.
I guess from time immemorial, monster stories have also played a role in trying to keep kids alive, because it's one thing to say, don't go in the woods, stay out of the water. It's another thing to say a sprite's going to grab you and pull you in, or a wolf is going to grab you, and those are scary and for a purpose.
Yeah, that's true. You know, it's funny that we're very familiar with the werewolf story, partly because the werewolf comes out of Northern Europe, and where wolves really were a threat, and so these legends were probably very useful in getting kids to be more cautious and careful. But there's actually a were-tiger legend in India, and there's a were-bear in Native Americans, and there's even a were-crocodile in Indonesia and Africa. So I do think monsters have played this role in many different cultures.
Well, there are interesting takes on that, too, because sometimes the werewolf, and I'll assume were-bear, were-tiger story, takes on this dimension where the thing that has been, the person who has been taken over by this force really doesn't want to do anything wrong and sort of begs those around him to lock him away when things get dangerous.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you see this more as a result of the modern monster story. It's not so much there in the ancient world where the sort of monsters are sort of pure evil. Mm-hmm. But in the West, we've had an increasingly liberal, and I mean small L liberal, more and more tolerant society developing. And so monsters have been reconfigured and reconceptualized so that they're not just evil, you know, the spawn of Cain, as they used to be referred to. In some cases, they're actually just outcasts that have been misunderstood or they've been treated badly, and so their monstrosity is a result of this mistreatment, or their gentle giants gone bad. And so you see that as early as the Frankenstein story, mm-hmm. where Victor Frankenstein sort of abandons his creation and doesn't give it a proper childhood, and that's what creates the rage in the monster. But even as recent as I talk about Beowulf, and the latest version of Beowulf for Hollywood had the monster was actually just sort of an outcast who was misunderstood, and Beowulf, the hero, had been transformed into kind of a jerk who just didn't really have the right empathy or sympathy. So it's an interesting change.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phones now to John in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Hi. Here's a question on old Gothic cathedrals, like I think Notre Dame and Chartres, Reims, and even some modern skyscrapers. There are these almost demonic-looking gargoyles. What's the legend or the folklore about gargoyles?
Yeah, that's a great question. I didn't do much research on this specifically, but it really does pique my interest as well. And my understanding is that this is part of an old animistic tradition that predates even Christianity, and so Christianity just sort of continued it. And it's the idea that you can ward off evil spirits by sort of either appeasing them with gifts and offerings or by scaring them and keeping them away in that way. And so many of the architectural grotesques, you know, the gargoyles, are descendants of that sort of old animistic tradition that it's just sort of supernaturalism that's made its way, you know, through these different theological traditions, that this holy place will not allow, you know, bad demons or malevolent spirits to enter, and so they act as a kind of guardian. That's one interpretation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. An email here from Paul in Terrell asks, how did monsters in popular culture, especially aimed at children, become cuddly and cute? Early Disney films scared kids into nightmares, but now we have Shrek.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a psychodynamic happening here, which is that we're afraid of some gigantic ogre, and we've basically had all these traditions of fear, stay out of the woods and stay away from strangers and malevolence like this. But if you can transform them into cuddly characters, you can basically get your fears under control. It's a way of sort of taking something that can sort of potentially unravel you, like fear and anxiety, and basically put it back in its box, put it back in its place, show that you have rational control over it, that it's not a real threat, it's just an imaginary threat. And so this restores our sense of security and order, and it's sort of like, you know, in almost all horror films, at least until very recently, the endings were always sort of the heroes would prevail. Mm-hmm. Either the military or the average Joe Sixpack would figure out a way to kill the creature. So no matter how much havoc the thing wreaks, you can still basically show that human beings and their rationality can conquer this. And I think part of turning monsters into cute things, there's, you know, Monsters, Inc. is another example, is part of this process of sort of distancing ourselves from it so that we're not too freaked out by these fears and anxieties.
Yeah, well, even if you look at a production like Sesame Street, which did it quite deliberately, they call them monsters and make no bones about that's what they are.
Exactly. It does take some of the potential, like, debilitating fears about monsters away and says, look, you know, here's a guy that everybody thinks he's a monster. He lives in a trash can. And, yes, he's grouchy, but look, you know, deep down he's got a good heart. And it's a moral message that we send to our kids. And I think as adults we tell ourselves versions of this as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that we can come away sometimes from monster stories or movies or entertainment oddly comforted, and somehow we feel like, oh, we're actually safe. Even though we've been through this emotional experience empathizing with the characters on screen, we're okay.
Yeah, the limbic system, you know, is the part of the brain that gets triggered during fear. And it's almost like we get this little holiday. We get to have this limbic experience of fear and anxiety and dread. But then, you know, the fact that it's art or entertainment allows us this distance. You know, we have a kind of catharsis. We can get it out of our system. And our heart was racing just now, but we're back, you know, we're in a theater seat, we're all okay. And I think there's something, it's like a little holiday to the reptile brain, and then we can come back and get back to our regular lives of, you know, mortgages and kids and going to school and that kind of thing. So I think it actually may play a healthy psychological function as well.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Galen on the line in Plano. Hi, Galen.
Hey, how you doing, Chris?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you. I had a quick question. I was curious, is it interesting, does your guest find it interesting that certain cultures nowadays, specifically like the African-American culture here in America, doesn't have monster stories?
That they do not have monster stories? Is that what you're asking?
Well, yeah, you don't really see horror movies by like a lot of black producers or anything like that. It's not really a genre that, I'm African-American myself, that you see a lot of work being put into.
Before we get Stephen's answer to that, why do you think that is, Galen? Do you have a theory?
Personally, from talking with different friends that are interested in that question, we just think that maybe the stories of our lives are already scary enough, so to speak, if you look at it historic and recent history.
Yeah, what do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, I actually would agree with that interpretation. It would be interesting to sort of do a social science survey and see whether these anecdotes would add up to a general theme like that. But in my sort of study of the history of monsters, it is oftentimes like, you know, the artistic stories about monsters or entertainment about monsters usually come when people are feeling relatively secure. They're not really under threat from zombies and so forth. But if you were historically have been from an oppressed group, like African Americans have been in this country, I can't imagine a scenario where fears and anxieties don't need, you know, sort of fictional representation. They're sort of real and identifiable out in the larger culture. So it does make sense to me. I just don't know for sure.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The idea that I guess if monster stories are going to fall off if you know exactly who the enemy is and it's quite real.
Right, exactly. You don't need to. Embellishing would always be there, and I think racial groups have always embellished each other across the racial divide, as have ethnic groups. And one of the things I try to trace in the book is how far back this goes. So, for example, during the Crusades, Christians definitely demonized Muslims, but it went the other way as well, and there's a large body of sort of demonizing of the West part of Muslim culture, too. So this is an interesting story about people that are meeting each other and having sort of unequal power distributions and struggles.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Mark in Dallas. Hello, Mark.
Hi, how are you, Chris?
Very well, thanks.
I'd just like to make a comment. We're talking monsters. And it's interesting how the Christian religion, especially in this country, has demonized gay people.
What do you think about that, Stephen?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear. He demonized what?
Gay people.
Oh, yeah, that I think is in keeping with what I would call the more pernicious aspects of monsterology, which is when you have something that's different from you, make moral judgments based on what gives them visceral disgust. What you'll find is that people will then reconsider or reconceptualize those people as monstrous or as demons. And that, I think, is just a very sad fact about human nature, but something we can fix. This is one of those problems that can be educated. You know, we got a lot of problems that you can't really do much about, but this one strikes me as one that enough education and experience with other people changes that. So, for example, it's very easy to demonize or monsterize people who are homosexual if you're heterosexual until you get to know people who are homosexual, just like it was easy to demonize African Americans or it's easy to demonize Jews. But the more you actually experience people and find out that what makes them tick is basically the same kind of thing that makes you tick with some, deviations, the less likely we are to see people as monsters. So proximity helps clear up some of the xenophobia that we sort of naturally seem to have.
It almost sounds like exposure therapy for people who have phobias to things that are irrational.
Yeah, it's a good analogy to draw because one of the things I'm talking about early in the book is how universal we seem to find fears of snakes, spiders, big cats, and things like crocodiles.
Mm-hmm.
And this seems to cut across all of the cultures. And I think this is partly because we all evolved, from the same area. But also I think there's some way to, like you said, through with therapy, mitigate some of this and reduce some of the anxiety and phobia. So I think the same is true about human beings with each other.
Stephen T. Asma is my guest. He's professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago and author of the book On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago, Stephen T. Asma. His book is called On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We haven't yet talked much about the monster story as sexual metaphor, and clearly in both older and brand new vampire stories, there's a lot of sex going on here.
Yeah, that's right.
Or not going on, is the case maybe in Twilight.
Yeah, the vampire monster seems to be, has served so many different functions, over time. But I think that is one of the continuous aspects of it from its original story. John Polidori writes The Vampire, and then we have the Dracula of Bram Stoker. And in those early phases, right down to the present, the Twilight stuff, vampires are generally considered sexually attractive, elite, highly cultured. They're people that you want to be with. They're the opposite of zombies, the proletarians of the zombie world. And I think that they represent, in part, some of the dangers of sexuality and romance. Obviously, after AIDS, you had a whole other aspect of the vampire story having to do with contagion and worries about blood.
Hmm.
But those fears have also always been there, even back to the original stories, but also just the romantic aspects. Here's somebody that's highly attractive, but in some sense they can break your heart. They're alluring, but at the same time they're cold and inhuman in a sense. They won't be there for you when you need them. They're not good husband or wife material.
They're like the one-night stands of the monster world.
Exactly. That's right. And I think a lot of that's playing out. And one scholar I read was made this sort of provocative claim that in today's hookup culture, where young people sort of engage in these one-nighters, the sort of traditional romantic aspects of the Twilight series is something that's very attractive to people, because even though, you know, there's vampires, there's still a lot of romance in the traditional sense. You know, I'll die for you, I'll kill and die for you, that kind of stuff.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Neil in Dallas. Hey, Neil.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So, you know, I just was wondering what your caller had to think, or what your guest had to think about, you know, the whole Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. You know, there's a monster in all of us, split personalities. And then also, you know, creating, I believe, you know, it's the kind of the mad scientist in the lab creating a monster, you know. So it's like the monster creating a monster.
Yeah, these are great. Great themes. The Jekyll Hyde theme really gets picks up speed in the late 19th century and occupies the 20th century. And I think that's really right. The caller's right. There's a sense in which some of our greatest fears have to do with the alien aspects of ourselves, things that come out of us in moments of rage or lust that even surprise us. And in a way, the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde story is a sort of metaphor for what Freud would call the id, these sort of unconscious and dark desires that we, generally speaking, keep a lid on, but it can come crashing out and ruin our lives. And so I think that's a fascinating story. I try to detail, connect that issue with the serial killers of today in the book. And also I agree, the other example he gave is a nice one, the idea that you know, the Frankenstein scenario where the scientist creates a creature that comes back to basically destroy him and his family, it's being retold today in ways that it could, you know, no previous era could have done, because we have these amazing advances in biotechnology, cloning. And so I think this is really going to be a focus for the next few decades, is the human beings overstepping their bounds as human beings and playing God, and then creating these unstoppable creatures.
So Mary Shelley really gave birth to the tradition that led to 2001 and AI and Blade Runner and ideas like that.
I think that's right, that in many cases these more recent versions using AI and artificial life and scenarios like that are sort of just giving the latest nuance on the Frankenstein fear, which is an old one, and it's basically a fear about science. Is it the case that scientists are going to become so concerned with solving a technical scientific problem that they lose their heart and emotional connection, their humanity? And you see this get played over and over again in the movies. You know, it's the mad scientist who forgets that he's supposed to be on the human side, on the human team, and he goes over to help the aliens or whatnot. This is a classic sort of parody of science as being heartless.
So let's talk a little bit more about these modern-day sort of real-life monsters. Most of us are less likely to die at the hands of a serial killer or a terrorist than to win the lottery, but somehow it feels very real and very threatening when we hear about somebody else being victimized.
I think that's right. We have a tendency to think that threat is more real than it probably is. On the other hand, many of us do encounter aggression, you know, in our daily lives. Somebody just happens to lose it at a ball game or whatever, and it's a frightening experience. And, you know, I'm living in Chicago. It's an urban center. There's a lot of crime in our cities. And so the monster sort of plays this role as a surrogate criminal. How do we sort of respond? In the case of the serial killer, it's a little different. It's not just, you know, somebody wants your money or has become angry in the course of an argument. But in the case of these folks, they're what I call sort of the cold, detached monsters. They're not overwhelmed by emotion. They actually don't feel much emotion. And that's another set of dangers. They actually lack empathy. And so for example, I talked to one of the last guys to sort of interview serial killer John Wayne Gacy. And this guy's done a lot of work with serial killers. And he says, overwhelmingly, these people don't feel the empathy. They don't feel the suffering of other people. They're kind of just, in terms of those emotions, they're kind of dead inside. And we see that time and again in these scenarios. So that's a different kind of monster, one that's just sort of emotionally off, in the off position.
Was fear of clowns really as common as it is today before John Wayne Gacy?
I'm not sure.
You're so laughing, but they're kind of scary.
I know, they are scary. That's why I'm laughing, is so many people, including myself, are frightened by...
I don't like them either.
I honestly am not sure what the cause of this is. My only theory that I can make sense of, with it is Freud has this idea of the uncanny, where there's something that's sort of at the same time simultaneously familiar and unfamiliar.
So that painted
clowns
face.
Clowns are like this, you know. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be fun and comforting, but in fact, their faces are, you know, covered by this strange makeup, and they're wearing these bizarre outfits, and somehow it just doesn't work. It's a combination of these two contradictory emotions. I'm not sure.
What do you make of Halloween and the fact that so many of us like to not only dress up as something that is scary, but dress up as a victim of a monster?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting issue. Things like Halloween, and most cultures have a similar kind of day or a week, you know, maybe it's even like a Fat Tuesday or something, where you can let down your hair, so to speak, unbutton your shirt, you know, metaphorically, and go wild.
Mm-hmm.
And cultures have been successful by having these little pressure release valves mm-hmm. where people can get kind of nuts on one night. And then after they get this out of their system, they can return to their regular lives. And I think Halloween does that. It allows people to sort of play at being a radically different kind of a person. And in part, you give way to your own desires and drives. Maybe it is the case that all of us are afraid of being victims, and then perhaps dressing up like a victim helps us to then manage that emotion and feel better about it. I noticed, for example, this is kind of unrelated but connected, there's a fascination these days with what I call murderabilia, which is people want to buy paintings by, you know, John Wayne Gacy or something Manson once owned, and then they have these things, and it's kind of sick and disgusting on the one hand. On the other hand, it's a way to distance yourself. Like I've purchased, you know, some serial killer's comb on eBay, and, you know, it's a way of managing with money, you know, in a kind of financial transaction, something that ordinarily would just scare the bejesus out of us. And so there may be something going on like that. We're trying to sort of distance ourselves from our deeper fears.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones now. This time on the line in Fort Worth, we are speaking with Zach. Hi, Zach.
Hi. This is a question that I've heard before, and it's always something that's interesting to me. It's that during economic times, our perception of what is a monster and scary changes, that when people are feeling secure in themselves and in their station, that the monster attacks tend to be aliens or something inhuman, and when they're not feeling secure that way, it manifests in like a slasher or something that is human but acts inhumanly. And I'll go ahead and take my answer off the air.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I think that's right. And you see that if you're sort of a film historian, you can kind of track a little bit of this. Oftentimes, the threat will reflect what's happening in the wider culture. So earlier we were talking about, you know, the classic 1950s Cold War horror films were largely about creatures that could take the shape of your neighbor, but be sort of a kind of stand-in for communism. And after the Vietnam War, people noticed an uptick in horror films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and other sort of serial killer horror. And if the caller's right, you might be able to argue that, you know, in wartime, where there's so much sort of bloodshed going on, there's a way to express that in films that are mostly about deranged, inhuman human beings rather than sort of ghosts or aliens from another planet. And so I think you see this cropping up. When one of the sort of really popular horror directors now, Eli Roth, he makes these what I consider very sadistic torture porn films, the Hostel series. And many people, you know, find his films very frightening, but they're very popular. And he defended them, interestingly, by saying, well, you know, I get a lot of mail from soldiers in the Middle East, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, who say that they love my movie because it allows them to kind of, you know, you can't show fear on the battlefield. There's too much at stake. But here back at the camp, at the compound, you know, we can watch the films together and sort of get scream, basically, all together as a group, and it has this cathartic function. So, yeah, I think a lot of that is going on. We can connect horror and our interest in monsters with what's happening in the larger economic and political arena.
We should say that the book contains some really spectacular pencil and pen and ink drawings that you made yourself. Is this something that you got in the habit of working on even when you were a kid?
Yes. Thanks for the compliment. I've always been sort of interested in drawing monsters, even when I was little, and so the book afforded me this opportunity to be able to do my own renditions of some of these things, which was a total blast. And I think that monsters exist in the pictorial traditions of the West. You know, long before we had a sort of science of the monsters or theories about monsters, we had artists trying to convey, you know, these horrifying visions. You know, you think about Hieronymus Bosch painting what he thinks hell looks like. And it's, I look at those paintings now, and they were done in the Renaissance, and I think they're still frightening and scary.
You know, I have to confess, there are some photographs in the book as well of things, biological phenomena that people have labeled monsters. And they are insidious in a way, because you feel ashamed for looking at these things, and yet you are really curious. I was really curious about them.
Yeah, I tell this story that I think represents, you know, not just myself, but a lot of people. In the book, I'm in a museum in England called the Hunterian, and it's filled with all the ways that nature can go wrong. There are these big sort of jars of alcohol with conjoined twins floating in it, and all kinds of what were previously called monsters. We now call them, it's called teratology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was a little kid in there with his mom, and he was gasping in disgust and fright at the sight of these things. And the mom said to him, you know, is this disturbing to you? And he said, yeah, oh, God, yeah, it's totally disturbing. And then the mom said, well, should we go? Should we leave? And he said, no, absolutely not. So I thought it was interesting, you know, that we do have this attraction and repulsion relationship with monsters of all kinds.
Stephen T. Asma is professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago and author of On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. Stephen, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.